Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Fifth episode of The Last Dance. Played some of the familiar hits last night, like Jerry Krause, had some weird takes. Michael Jordan hates Jerry Krause. Then you had Michael Jordan hates Isaiah Thomas. Then you had somebody else getting humiliated. In other words, some of the familiar hits. Why don't we start with Krause? In case you had forgotten about Jerry Krause, pretty early on in episode 5, you have yet another reminder from him that 1998 was going to be Phil Jackson's last season with the Bulls. And if Michael Jordan really meant it when he said that he would not play for any other coach, then that's fine. He can go with Phil. That was Krause's take, and he made it for the record yet again. And that take will never be anything other than really dumb to me. I mean, that is a legendarily dumb take. Let's see, we've got Mike Jordan. But we're going to let him walk after 6 rings because I'm the GM and I don't like the head coach. And by the way, if you're the GM, what the hell is there not to like about the head coach? Like, I understand Jackson could be kind of arrogant and off-putting. I understand all that. But if you're the GM, what is not to like about that head coach? He won 6 rings, or would have after that season. Is that not the point of the game? Isn't that the point of the business? To win everything. And Phil was doing that. And on top of that, you know, those teams, contrary to popular belief, were not easy to coach. That was not just a matter of just rolling the ball out for Mike. Huge egos, huge personalities, all of which had to be managed. And Jackson did a great job. He literally was the best man for that gig and was killing the gig. Yet Krause wanted to run him off because he didn't like him. And he wanted to run him off, and if he did, that meant losing Jordan as well. Again, an all-time horrible take. I mean, can you imagine even thinking that, much less saying it loud, out loud, over and over again? And again, where the hell was the owner, Jerry Reinsdorf, to talk him off that point? And of course, the stupidity of that was shortly erased by the coolness of the 98 All-Star Game in New York City. Transition. Because that's the thing about that doc. It's kind of interesting the way they jump around, right? Between timelines. Jordan at the Garden is always legendary. Jordan at the Garden in an All-Star Game is even better. And Jordan at the Garden in an All-Star Game talking about Kobe before that game really is the best.
I don't think the boys want to take everybody one-on-one.
I know, right?
We talking about Kobe?
Yeah. He don't let the game come to him. Mm-hmm. He just go out there and take it.
He's going to take people. He's going to make his game.
Make I'm going to make this a one-on-one game.
Yeah. Look, I figured after the first 4 attempts, it didn't go.
What? After the first 4 attempts, if I was a teammate, I wouldn't pass him the ball. Hey, you want this ball again, brother. You better rebound.
That was cool as hell, actually. That was Mike talking to his Eastern Conference teammates about Kobe and how they would deal with Kobe. And then Magic comes into the locker room, and Jordan's giving it to him. And then there was Larry in the hallway. If the entire episode was just an hour of guys talking crap at the All-Star game, I would have been pumped. And then you had this from Kobe.
At that point, Michael provided a lot of guidance for me. Like, I had a question about shooting his turnaround shot, so I asked him about it. And, you know, he gave me a great detailed answer. But on top of that, he said, if you ever need anything, give me a call. It's like my big brother. You know, I truly hate having discussions about who would win one-on-one. And you're a fan saying, hey, Kobe, you beat Michael one-on-one. I feel like, yo, what you get from me is from him. I don't get 5 championships here without him because he guided me so much and gave me so much great advice.
That part of that episode was so surreal. It's so surreal to see Kobe talking like that and to know that he's not actually here anymore. That will never not be surreal. And as much as you could see Jordan's love for Kobe at the memorial, and think about that for a minute. Now that you've been watching Mike in this episode, and how hardcore Mike is, isn't it amazing to see him just dump and pour that emotion the way he did at the memorial for Kobe. It tells you how strongly he felt about Kobe. And you see that, but then you see that clip last night, and you can see the love and respect flowing from Kobe back to Mike. Quote, "I don't win five championships here without him," end quote. That's pretty much the highest praise you will ever hear. I've never heard Kobe say anything like that before. And then you have the episode shifting to the Dream Team experience. And of course, if we're talking Dream Team in this doc, then we're talking about not the guys who made the team, but we're talking about the guy who did not make the team. According to Jordan.
Before the 92 Olympics, Rod Thorne calls me and says, "We would love for you to be on the Dream Team." I says, "Oh, who's all playing?" He says, "What does that mean?" I say, "Who's all playing?" You know, he says, "Well, the guy you're talking about, or you're thinking about, he's not going to be playing."
Mike. Of course, the guy that Mike was talking about or thinking about, of course, was Isaiah Thomas. And in case you had somehow forgotten in the past 7 days, Michael Jordan still does not think very highly of Isaiah Thomas. In fact, Mike hates him. Not hated him, but hates him still, right now, even as we speak. Not my words, MJ's words. I am not reading into this. He flat out says it.
I respect Isaiah Thomas's talent. To me, the best point guard of all time is Magic Johnson, and right behind him is Isaiah Thomas. No matter how much I hate him, yeah, I respect his game. Now, it was insinuated that I was asking about him, but I never threw his name in there.
I mean, it really is amazing to me that nearly 30 years later, he still hates Isaiah as much as he does right now. He still hates him as much right now as he did then. I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm actually impressed.
No matter how much I hate him.
Now, in other spots, like Jack McCallum's Dream Team book, it appears that Jordan did actually say something about Isaiah. According to McCallum, he spoke to both Rod Thorne and Chuck Daly about Isaiah. And generally, what we're seeing right now is Mike's version of everything. I mean, that's the whole point of the doc, right? Mike had to sign off on it. Mike's got veto power over it. So we're getting Mike's version of everything, or the version that he wants to present right now, which is fine. I mean, whether he did or did not actually say something, it doesn't really matter. Because he didn't actually have to say anything at all. He didn't have to say how he felt about Isaiah, because everybody already knew. And it's not like Scottie Pippen liked Isaiah. Pippen didn't want him on that team. Magic was also having issues with Isaiah then. So I don't know whether or not Mike ever hit them with a "it's him" or "it's me" ultimatum. My point is, he didn't need to. USA Basketball already knew. And they knew Mike. So they had to know that if they wanted Mike to commit to the Olympics, it was going to be a hell of a lot easier to do so without Isaiah. And as great a player as Isaiah was, it's not like they needed him to win. Far from it. Now, one guy who did make the team was Clyde Drexler. So you would think that this would be a pretty cool episode for Clyde. And if you would think that, you'd be wrong. Because every episode has a guy who's going to get crushed. Jerry Krause, Craig Elo, and last night it was Clyde Drexler. And all Clyde did was have the misfortune of being compared to Michael Jordan. Key phrase, being compared to Michael Jordan. He did not compare himself to Michael Jordan. He had somebody else do it. And it was the worst thing that could have happened to Clyde and the Blazers, because you knew it was only going to piss Mike off.
Clyde was a threat. You know, I'm not saying he wasn't a threat, but me being compared to him, I took offense to that.
Add that to the list of Mike's reasons to go. Somebody being compared to me. And to the question of what did Clyde do again, the answer is, you know what Clyde did? I'll tell you exactly what Clyde did to get on the wrong side of Mike. He played basketball really well. And then somebody else made the mistake of comparing him to Mike. That is some next level fuel. And petty, honestly. Clyde Drexler is one of the greatest players in the history of the game. And Jordan was taking offense that somebody compared the two of them. And you knew as soon as you heard that, you knew Clyde was going to catch some. And he did. You got the Jordan shrug in game one, and then it was officially on. Jordan goes out. He attacks him every single night in the finals. And it continued on even in practice for the Dream Team. So if there's a moral to this series, the moral is, if Michael does not like you, he won't just try to beat you. He's there to humiliate you. He's not looking to only win. He's looking to rip your soul. He's looking to destroy you. It doesn't matter what you do, or in fact, if you do nothing at all, like Clyde. What did Clyde do other than play the game at a Hall of Fame level and help his team? You might be like Clyde Drexler, just going out there, minding your own business, being great, and then have some random person with the audacity to compare you to Jordan. Jordan hears about it, and now you have to pay. And Clyde had to be like, damn, the hell did I ever do to this guy? I know that he hates Isaiah, but what did I ever do to him? I'll tell you what you did, Clyde. You played well enough for somebody else to compare you to him, and now it's your ass, Clyde. Instead of The Last Dance, they should have just titled this doc, Here's a List of Guys That Michael Jordan Hates. And I'd still watch it, because there is no hatred like Michael Jordan hatred of someone. That's the purest, cleanest burning rocket fuel ever. Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially the frontline workers who provide resources and care for those most in need. To help, LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that need to quickly fill critical roles with the people who help us all. So if you're hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people for your frontline. LinkedIn can help you find frontline workers from its active community of over 675 million members. I am one of the 675 million. I'm on the site every single day. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and experience that you're looking for and puts your job post in front of qualified people who meet your requirements so you can find the right person to quickly fill critical roles. To post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and you have hiring needs, just visit linkedin.com/Rome, linkedin.com/ROME. Terms and conditions apply. He is Therese Paylor. Therese, what's going on? How are you?
I'm fantastic, Jim. Thanks for having me on again.
Good to have you back. All right, so let me start with the Chiefs. It was announced last week that they were announcing the fifth-year option for Pat Mahomes. What was your reaction to that, and exactly what does that mean for his contract situation going forward?
It's what I expected. Most of the time, you know, you're going to accept that option when the player has fulfilled his obligations and lived up to expectations. Mahomes has obviously gone above and beyond in that regard. I also think that there will be an extension done with him. Obviously, the team loves the player, and I think the thing you have to remember is that the people who really push to help make him a member of the organization are the ones in charge. So typically when there's investment like that and buy-in, there's no real hesitation to pay a guy, right? So it's just a matter of kind of working it all out and getting that part done. But he does want to be a Chief for a long time. And they absolutely want him to be a Chief for a long time. So I really don't foresee a lot of issues as far as that getting done, as long as the climate, in the country, as far as the money situation with the league and the uncertainty in the fall doesn't, play, a huge role in it.
Therese Paylor joining us. You know, speaking of Mahomes, last week there was that documentary of Alex Smith detailing the injury he suffered in Washington and working his way back from that. For those who do not know Alex Smith, what's he like as a person?
Outstanding person, beloved teammate, professional. You know, I think, you've done it for a long time, Jim, so, you appreciate, the importance of being there every day and being accountable and, kind of leading from the front and having your teammates' backs and all that. And, I saw him do that, Alex do that every day for 5 years. I was a Chiefs beat writer at the Kansas City Star during his entire tenure there. And he was a beloved teammate. He was a guy that, no matter how tough the questions got, he always answered them. No matter how bad things got, he was always right there to answer the questions respectfully, answer them well, thoughtfully, right? He was a leader of that team, and that's why, I think Mahomes got so much respect from his teammates when he first joined the team, and he was deferential to Alex because he respected that dynamic. And that's one of the reasons Alex was so willing to help him. And he was a great, great mentor for Patrick Mahomes the 1 year Mahomes sat And I think that if you're a team drafted a young quarterback, you can't draw it up any better than the dynamic they had. So I was actually glad, Jim, that people got a chance to see Alex the person, Alex the leader, Alex the kind of resilient spirit that I saw for 5 years when he was the starting quarterback in Kansas City.
I agree with you. It's amazing what he's trying to overcome and the way he continues to battle and fight and grind, and what a great teammate he was there. Therese Paylor is my guest. All right, so let me quickly jump to Miami for a minute. I'm curious, Therese, about your thoughts. What do you make of how they approach their draft, and how do you think it's going to play out over this season and the coming years?
Jim, I love their draft. Listen, I spent a lot of time studying the game of football. You know, I'm dorky like that. And I look at their roster right now, and I see, you know, everything they kind of need in place to make that run in the next couple of years. And I actually think they're going to be a little friskier than people think this year. A couple of reasons for that. First of all, I watch a lot of football, man. And, like, at the end of last year, I was even watching their games, like, when the season was over and stuff. Like, I was watching their games late in the year when they had no chance of making the playoffs. They were still playing hard. Jim, like, those guys are playing hard for Brian Flores, which I think really speaks well to him as a coach, and is like a really positive thing if you're a fan of that team. And then I look at what they did in the draft, and I mean, listen, you draft Tua Tagovailoa, which is a risk, but if they hit on that pick, he could be the best quarterback in this draft. You know, I said a couple years ago he had a little Steve Young in him, and at the very least is Mark Brunell, as long as he can stay healthy. There's a lot of talent in that guy, and what I like the most about it, though, is that they started to give him an infrastructure to kind of build around him, right? With their next first-round pick, they took Austin Jackson, their future starting left tackle. With their second-round pick, they took Robert Hunt, who has Pro Bowl ability at guard. He could be a Pro Bowl guard. In the fourth round, they took Solomon Kinley, who can be a starting guard in this league. They spent money on Eric Flowers in free agency, and they drafted a guard last year in the third round of Michael Dieter, a top 100 pick. You know, this is how you build a team. You know, if you're going to draft Tua Tagovailoa with his injury history, you're going to want to put a young, stout offensive line in front of him. And the best thing is, it sounds like they also understand this. If you're going to draft that guy, you got to put him on the Mahomes plan, right? He sits the first year. He goes against a scout team. He learns what he can and cannot do, with the added aspect of you building up his body, rehabbing the injury, so he gets to hit the ground running in 2021. And the thing I like about this plan, provided they can stick to it, all these linemen I just told you about will have gotten a year older, a year stronger, and they'll be more, they'll have some continuity then, and they have a better chance of protecting them. So I actually love their plan. I'm looking at their depth chart. I think there's a lot of talented young players. And, you know, this is a team that's going to be a little more frisky than people think this year, and they're going to be able to challenge Buffalo next year.
Therese Paylor joining us. All right, then let me ask you about another young quarterback or two. What about Justin Herbert? How do you like that fit with Herbert and the Chargers and the weapons he's going to have around him?
You can argue that, you know, second to Joe Burrow, you know, he's got the best group of support. He's got the best supporting cast around him to hit the ground running. You know, so people sleep on Cincinnati because they were bad last year, but, you know, between A.J. Green, T. Higgins, Tyler Boyd, and Johnny Ross and Joe Mixon, they're good there, right? But I'm looking at the Chargers, and it's like, hey, you know, Keenan Allen, Mike Williams, I like that. I like that a lot for a quarterback in Herbert, who has a lot of physical ability but might not be able to carry you just yet. He has a chance to grow into that role, but between those guys and Austin Eckler, Hunter Henry, there's a lot around him skill-wise. I do have some concerns about their offensive line. I'm not going to lie about that. Trey Turner, they got him. I like him, but, you know, him and Bulaga, that's good on the right side, but they still got a big issue at left tackle. And this is not the league or the division to have that kind of issue. So they need Trey Pipkins to step up. But I like the fit because what he does well, he's a movement quarterback, big arm, can create with his feet. He just has to stop thinking so much and stop processing, start playing the game. I do think they can build an offense around his strengths, though. And I think if that offensive line could take a step forward and they can get more out of some of those young draft picks they've had the last 3 years on the interior of the line, that's got a chance to really work out. But they do need that line to come together for that to work.
Terrez Paylor joining me for a few more moments. I've got to ask you also about the Eagles taking Jalen Hurts in the second round. Listen, they're not taking a quarterback in the second round. Just have this guy stand around for a few years. Assuming Carson Wentz remains healthy, which has been an issue, how do you think Doug Peterson uses Hurts this season?
I think Peterson's reaction during the draft after the Hurts selection tells us everything we need to know. He was sitting there beaming, smiling. Very excited. Now, I had a chance to cover Doug Peterson 3 years when he was in Kansas City as the offensive coordinator under Andy Reid. He's a very creative man, someone who reminds me of Andy in the sense that he really gets juice out of, like, calling up fun plays. That's what he's coaching for, right? We kind of got a sense of that in the Super Bowl win that they had, right? So I think people, in specifically Philly fans, you can't be short-sighted about what this is. This is not just Carson Wentz protection because we know that he gets hurt. I think there's an opportunity, a special opportunity here to kind of push the NFL forward offensively. Yeah, because of the way officials have started loosely kind of calling RPOs, like offensive linemen can run downfield and you can still pass it. But there's a real opportunity here to exploit this with two players on the field who are athletic and throw the football and can both throw the football. You know, you can, like, run combo RPOs, two or three of them on the same play. I actually think there's going to be Jalen Hurts packages, and I think we're going to see more of him with Carson Wentz than people think. Like, there is a way to line Jalen Hurts up next to Carson Wentz, run an RPO right there, and then somehow get the ball into Hurts' hands and run another RPO. Like, that's possible. And it's going to be really fun to see how the Eagles try to push this thing into the future, because I do think because of Hurts' body build, he's a stout guy, he's really strong in premium athleticism and ability to throw the ball. I think there's an opportunity here to really kind of push things forward offensively and create an offense where you've got two quarterbacks on the field at the same time most of the time and defenses are struggling to adjust.
Terrez Paylor joining us. All right, one last thought. I've got to ask you this, because watching The Last Dance last night, I was struck by how often that doc catches Michael Jordan smoking a cigar. And it's not just after winning a title. It seems like a pretty regular thing. I bring that up because a few months back, you did a piece on one of the most iconic athlete smoking photos ever. Len Dawson taking a drag on a cigarette during halftime of the first Super Bowl. What is the story behind that photo?
Epic story, epic photo, obviously. Basically, here's the thing. When I talk to people about that story, the thing we all have to wrap our minds around the fact is that was common. Like, that was a common thing. Like, it's a rather unremarkable story and a rather unremarkable photo to the men in that locker room, because it will be common to come into the locker room at halftime and, like, there'd be, like, a plume of smoke in the air. Guys would be smoking like that. That's just the times. That's just how it was. And I think that more than anything is what stands out to me. Like, I was talking to Ed Buddy about that and Bobby Bell and all these guys, and they're all just saying, you know, that's just how they did it back in the day. And I actually did start to get phased out, like, through the 70s. You saw less of it, and especially in the 80s when we all kind of became more knowledgeable about what was going on in the tobacco industry and how dangerous that was. But in the 60s and that rough and tumble era of football, Jim, I'm telling you, I just couldn't believe how unaffected those guys were about it. Like, they're not – that photo is – they don't – some of them almost kind of don't understand why it's so huge, you know, and I think that's the story of it. It's just like it was so common to them that photo feels unremarkable to them.
It's an amazing story, and I love the part, too, that you spoke to Jan Stenerud when he joined Kansas City in 66 and that he was having his tryout. Dawson stops by, and, I mean, these guys were smoking on the sideline during games, but even better, Terrez, when that stadium opened up, they had ashtrays in the lockers.
Yes.
How incredible is that?
I heard that, and I just about doubled over. I was like, they had them installed into the locker. Yeah. And you know, that was, like, considered, like, an upgrade feature.
Right.
It was an upgrade feature. It's like guys would come in like, oh, yeah, we got our ashtrays in the locker. Okay. The Chiefs are doing it big. Okay.
Like, dude, have you seen their facility? Have you seen the facility, man? That these guys have ashtrays in the locker. Built-in ashtrays, dude.
It's insane.
That's where I want to be.
And you know what? Freddie Biletnikoff used to smoke on the sideline, too. Like, guys
incredible.
Smoking on the sideline. This is crazy.
Why not just do it in the huddle? Why not while you're running your route? Why not during the play? Be the best. Senior NFL writer for Yahoo, Hall of Fame voter, co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast. He is Therese Paylor. Therese, great job, man. Thanks so much.
Oh, anytime.
That was fun.
Thanks,
good job, as always. And that's not just the weekend tequila talking. Although I did bump into some of that. We are in the midst of a pandemic, right? What else is there to do? I'm talking about the World War III threats, the UFO sightings, the coronavirus pandemic talking. We're barely into the fifth month of this year. I can honestly say that if you told me Sasquatch was going to enter into the presidential race as a late third-party ad, I'd believe that. I mean, what the hell, right? Stranger headlines have already dropped, like this one from over the weekend. An actual headline, quote, "Murder hornets have made their way to the United States from Japan." I repeat, murder hornets have made their way to the United States from Japan. Right. Because, of course, they have. Why wouldn't they? What took so long? It's 2020. Murder hornets from Japan fit in perfectly to an absolutely cursed, absolutely bleeped up calendar year. Now, if you're thinking that maybe murder hornets is an exaggerated name for a harmless insect, you, of course, would be wrong. It's 2020. Are you not paying attention? Murder hornets are apparently exactly what they sound like. Hornets that murder. Now, before we get to that, let me tell you exactly what a murder hornet is. A murder hornet is the largest hornet in the world. This damn thing looks more like a bird than it does a bee. The biggest ones can get up to about 2 inches in length, which doesn't sound that big until you see one. And then you start having nightmares for the rest of your life. But it's not just the size that makes this thing scary. It's also the fact that apparently they can fly up to 20 miles per hour. And they've got venom that can be lethal to humans. Oh, and this, their jaws are shaped like shark fins. And they're designed to decapitate honeybees. Because the sole purpose of a murder hornet is to behead bees and feed their thoraxes to their young. Awesome, right? But the murder hornet name did not come from biting the heads off of honeybees and snacking off their lifeless bodies. Now, you don't get that name from something like that. It came from the 50 people a year in Japan who die from these a-holes. And guess what?
Guess what?
Guess what?
Guess what?
For the first time ever, they're here. They're here in the U.S. The very first sighting of the murder hornet occurred in Washington State. Man, there's a lot of jacked up stuff going on in the Pacific Northwest right now, isn't there? They saw one in Washington State, and they saw it back in November. Nobody knows just how in the hell murder hornets got here, but that doesn't really matter right now, does it? What matters is containing them, because according to scientists, if they're not completely eradicated by the year 2022, then murder hornets are here to stay forever. Now, the good news is, a single sting from a single murder hornet is unlikely to kill you. The bad news is they normally attack in groups, which sucks. Because people who've been stung say that it feels like, quote, hot metal driving into your skin. But why read about the pain of a murder hornet sting when you can hear it instead? Apparently there's some dude on the internet named Coyote Peterson who's made a living traveling around the world filming himself getting stung by the worst creatures imaginable. Think like Crocodile Hunter meets Jackass. So back in 2018, Coyote P went to Japan to find a murder hornet, aka a Japanese giant hornet, to get stung by. The video gets a massive bump over the weekend thanks to everybody scrambling to try to figure out what the hell this thing is. In a clip that has now been viewed 21 million times, Coyote catches a murder hornet, places it on his arm, and lets the damn thing impale him like a heroin junkie with its stinger.
I'm Coyote Peterson, and I'm about to enter the sting zone with the Japanese giant hornet. One, two, here we go. Oh, this thing is stuck in my arm. Oh.
Ooh. How bad is it?
Ah.
How bad is it? Listen to him.
Oh, searing pain. Absolute searing pain. There's where the stinger went in right there. Did you not see how slow this sting was? Oh.
I see blood.
Ah. Oh, my gosh.
That guy'd ask if homeboy is okay, but he's clearly not. The rest of that video is him rolling around on the ground for 5 minutes, screaming in pain. And if you think he's playing it up for the camera, check out the follow-up vid that he filmed the next day where his forearm is completely pink and swollen up to twice its normal size. So yes, that's the insect scientists have been trying to hunt down since November. That's the insect we are just now hearing about today. That is the insect that we need to eradicate in 2 years or less, or then it becomes embedded in the U.S. forever. Like I said, at this point, I'm numb. Like my man Ben Mezrich could probably write a novel about the attack of the giant killer insects like in 5 minutes or less. Might as well get that out there too, because that's coming. You know that's coming. Of course, we'd be getting closer to being allowed to go back outside, which is what we're all hoping for. But look what's waiting for us. The murder hornets. Yeah, you think it sucks being inside? Try going outside. All of a sudden, quarantine sounds pretty damn good. I'm telling you, this is 2020, and 2020 is drunker than all of us. And based on liquor sales, all of us are pretty drunk. But 2020 is drunker than all of us, and it simply will not go home. No, 2020 is slouched over the bar, ordering shot after shot after shot after shot. Hey, bartender, give me another shot of murder hornets, please. Make it a double. A shot of UFOs and a double shot of murder hornets. I'd ask 2020 what's next, but I don't really care. This thing came off the rails, came off the tracks a long time ago. Of course, the murder hornets are here.
How bad is it?
It doesn't sound like a can of Raid is going to take care of that either.
Searing pain. Absolute searing pain.
Like, I'm going to keep a can of Raid right alongside my mask in my glove compartment in the event I see one of those murder hornets.
Oh my gosh.
2020, man. And it's only May 4th. Clones, Capital One knows that life does not alert you about your credit card. Hey, couch surfers, we've got nonstop tunes to keep you rocking while you work. Oh, and Colleen. Yes, you, Colleen with a K. Your free trial of a Movie Plus ends tomorrow and your card may be charged. Do you want to continue or cancel? So, meet Eno, the Capital One assistant. Eno looks out for surprise charges, like when free trials expire, and it helps you if you need to fix them. Eno, another way Capital One is watching out for your money when you are not. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Limitations do apply. He is Nick Chubb. Nick, it is so good to have you on. Before we get into the offseason, Nick, and what you're doing with Victory, how are you and everybody around you doing during this very unusual time, Nick?
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be on the show talking to you right now. And, man, yeah, just like everybody else, man, I'm just uncertain, not knowing what's happening. So for myself, you know, I live in a small town, so I'm able to still go out and work out with my high school coach. So, I mean, not much has changed for me, honestly. This is what I do in every off season. So for me, it's been the same. But, you know, for my family, you know, they're not being able to go to work, and people I know are, you know, cut back on hours and, you know, things like that. Just unusual time. Not really knowing what's going to happen next. But yeah, I mean, I know. You know, I teamed up with Victory in order to, you know, help the healthcare workers now who work all these hours and who are fully committed to make sure we stay safe and healthy out there. And you know, we're able to provide insoles for their feet, you know, during the long hours of standing up. They have comfort and support in their shoes, and the feet feel good when they're working all these hours, you know, out there protecting us.
Good for you. What a great cause. And Nick, I want to say it's an extreme pleasure to have you on the program. I've been looking forward to it. It's good to have you. You know, you mentioned that you're getting your work in at your high school. Your coach there, Doyle Kelly, he was at Cedartown High School when you played. He said that last offseason you were lifting and working out with the kids. So this is not just because of the pandemic. You would still go back there and work with those kids. He says that you're always taking time to talk with the current players and give them advice. Why is that something that's so important to you?
I think for me, most just coming from a small town I came from, you know, people, just older guys who lived there before would always say, I should move away. I never get attention there. You know, college coaches don't come looking at this small town. You know, I'll never make it and things like that. So, I mean, that just motivated me to go harder in high school. And so now I use myself as an example for the kids who still go there. Like, you know, no matter if we do come from a small town, you know, you can still fulfill your dreams. You can still play college at D1 and you can still, you know, go to NFL. So I'm using myself as an example for them to keep them, you know, keep their head on straight and not listen to the outside world. Just keep focusing on what's important.
Nick Chubb is joining us. I'm going to talk to you about the Browns in 1 minute, but you mentioned what it was like to grow up in a small town. You played your college ball at Georgia, of course. As some people know, you grew up in Cave Spring and Cedartown, Georgia, but a huge part of your family's history is Chubbtown. It's a town that was founded by 8 brothers who were free men in the 1830s. What does Chubbtown and the history of your family mean to you?
Yeah, it's really a neat story. My black ancestors be free during that time, and not only be free, but to you know, create their own city during that time, and for it to be successful, and it means a lot. I mean, it just shows me that you know, there's no limit to what I can do if they you know endured all the pain and all the struggle during those times to you know run their own city. Then I have no excuse to do anything now when times are a little different than they were back then. So it just instilled in me just the hard work and dedication and to not ever, you know, settle or let anything get in my way.
Cleveland Browns running back Nick Chubb is joining us. You had that big rookie season, and then you had an absolutely huge season after that. As you look back, what was the biggest difference for you between year one and year two?
Year two, I was just more familiar with the offense. I was more comfortable. I knew everything, everything that was going to happen before it happened. Just, you know, study more. I was, you know, coached up on things a lot more. And it was just easy for me. It was just a lot more natural. Everything was just flowing for me, and I saw things a lot quicker, and, you know, it worked out.
You know, Nick, you had a great year. I think the team obviously went into the season with a lot of hype, a lot of expectation. Maybe things did not come together the way that they were expected to come together. As you look back on last season, and I understand you're looking ahead, but if I were to get you to look back on last season, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Nobody's ever asked me that yet. So, I mean, that's a typical question. I mean, like you said, it was just a lot of hype going into the season. We thought it was going to, you know, happen differently. But I said it before, I think we thought we were a lot better than we were, and we thought it was going to just happen for us. We didn't actually put the work in. So we just thought, we got this guy. I mean, we're straight. We don't need to actually work. It's just going to happen for us because, I mean, we're just so naturally talented. I mean, that just goes back to the old saying, you know, the hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work. So I think that's exactly what it was with us. I mean, we had all the talent in the world, but we just didn't, you know, put the work into it.
Nick Chubb joining us. I think that's a really honest answer. That's a really candid response. Does it feel like it's going to be different this time? Do you feel like the team learned from that and is going to move on and go on from that?
I honestly do. I think we saw the results of not working last year and just the disappointment that we all had. I mean, you talk to anybody on our team, we're all just disappointed in ourselves from, you know, every aspect of not working harder, allowing things to happen that shouldn't happen. And, yeah, man, but we made some changes. We got new coaches in. I feel like they're, you know, great coaching staff going to do everything right for us, put us in a position to win. And so, I mean, we just got to see. You know, it's tough right now because I know we're so eager to get back, get to work, so we can get that bad taste out of our mouths from last year. But we're having to wait. But we're still working on, you know, virtual offseason on our iPads with Zoom and, you know, all that stuff. I mean, we're still putting the work in, just not together.
We're talking to Nick Chubb. It's a very different time. Now, your teammates talk about the fact that they've never played with a guy who goes harder in practice than you do, that you do things one way, which is all out all the time. You know, some other guys might take it easy in practice and save themselves for Sunday. So where does your work ethic and that all-out approach come from? Every day, all day.
Yeah, I mean, that's just who I was from the beginning. I mean, it's always worked for me. In high school, my coaches pushed me to, you know, finish the run and do everything full speed, 100%. And, you know, some guys do look at it as like, you know, you got to save yourself for Sunday. But, I mean, me, I just get into a rhythm of finishing strong. And, you know, on Sunday, on game day, I don't have to think about it. It just comes natural to me. And even in college, I had a great coach, Brian McClendon. I think he's coaching the NFL somewhere. He was in South Carolina last year. But he's really the person who told me, you got to go hard every single day. Touch the field, you know. No excuses. You're not hurt. You're not banged up. When you touch that field, give it all you got 100%. And, man, I did that. And ever since then, it's been working for me. So I'm going to stick to what I know.
Hey, Nick, what about the Pro Bowl experience? I mean, whereas the team may not have had the success you were looking to have, you had a great individual year. What was that Pro Bowl experience like for you? And were there certain guys that you were looking to spend some time with and maybe pick their brains?
Yeah, it was a great experience. I think back to when I was a kid and just watching the Pro Bowl. And then, one day I'm like, I blink and I'm playing in it. And it's unreal. And you know, sometimes I sit back and really think about it. You know, I am just amazed at, you know, things I've been able to do. But it's been fun. You know, I got to go really with the running backs. I hung out with, you know, the guy who beat me in the rushing title, Derrick Henry. And not only that, but his college, you know, partner. They went together, I don't think, at the same time, but Mark Ingram. So just hanging out with those guys. You know, Mark, he's a vet, so they pick his brain about things. And just see how they, you know, what they look for when they run the ball and things like that.
And Nick, before you go, let me ask you this. The team, aside from the coaching change, which you referenced already, the team went out and added some talent on the line, both in free agency and in the draft. What do you make of those additions, and how much are you looking forward to running behind those guys?
Oh, yeah, I think they did a great job in offseason. Free agency and in the draft, picking up guys. They picked up two, you know, tackles who are, I think, unbelievable. And I think a lot of those guys can't wait to, you know, get on the field and practice with them and go in the game with them. I know they're eager to get out there too. So, I mean, it's just exciting. I think our coaching staff and our GM did a great job in the offseason of picking up new talent.
Nick, you hit this at the top. I want you to hit this on the way out too. You're working with Victory Gear today. In case somebody missed this or doesn't know, can you lay it out for me one more time? What exactly is that about, and what are you doing with Victory Gear?
Yeah, I teamed up with Victory Gear. You know, Victory for Heroes. It's a program. You know, this is a give back program to all the caregivers and the healthcare workers who are out there, you know, putting life on the line for us during these times, and you know, making sure we're safe and you know, medical and nursing and all that stuff. So what Victory does with the it's an insole, and it's like very comforting and very supportive and stable, and it helps, you know, the healthcare workers who are spending all these long hours on their feet, standing up, working, all this. It gives them comfort during their long days, and it's just very supportive and just a way we can, you know, find a way to give back to the people out there working for us right now.
Well done. Excellent. He's a running back for the Cleveland Browns, a Pro Bowler, second in the league in rushing last season with nearly 1,500 yards and eight touchdowns as well. First team All-SECer at Georgia. Nick, it is great to have you on the show. Appreciate you very much, and thanks for doing that.
All right. Thank you.
A story making the rounds right now is former Raiders quarterback Bruce Gronkowski, and he told a 9-person Zoom call made up of Pro Football Focus writers what it was like to back up Jamarcus Russell in Oakland. Jamarcus Russell, for those who do not remember, will go down as one of, if not the biggest bust in NFL history. I'm not saying this was a bad guy. I'm just saying he was a big time bust. I mean, like, the bust that all others are measured up against. A former first overall pick out of LSU, tapped to turn the Raiders franchise around, only to bomb out of the league after three seasons with a 7-18 record, 23 picks, 15 lost fumbles. The former top pick overall. And each win that he did produce for the Raiders came with a price tag of $5.7 million per win. Money extremely well spent. Psych. It should come as no surprise, then, that Jamarcus failed in the NFL, given his study habits. He didn't. Study, I mean. Not if you recall the legendary story of the coaches who sent him home with video to study. As the story goes, when the coaches asked him what he studied on that tape, he quickly told them blitz packages. They knew right then and there he was not doing the work because they sent him home with blank tapes. He straight up lied. Hey, so what did you see? What'd you study? Oh, blitz packages. Really? Because there's nothing on the tapes, Jamarcus. If that wasn't enough in and of itself to cement his legendary work ethic, this story from Bruce should do the trick. Check this out.
Tuesdays are our days off, but not for the quarterback. You'd always go in, watch film, get a workout in, prepare for who you're playing next. Jamarcus would never come in on Tuesdays. Myself and Charlie Fry were the backups. We took upon ourselves to try, how can we get him to watch some film on Tuesday? So we'd bring some DVDs to his house, and to get to his house, though, to him be up for this, we had to stop by Wendy's and pick up like 10 junior bacon cheeseburgers.
This is an absolutely incredible story. And right up your Clone Alley, right up the famous boulevard, right up the famous street known as Clone Alley. What an amazing story. Now, the audio on that was pretty good, but let me just read that back to you one time. Tuesdays are our days off, but not for the quarterback. Let me stop right there. Tuesday is an NFL off day. But those who really care find a way to get their work in anyway on Tuesdays. We know this. Quote, Tuesdays are our days off, but not for the quarterback. You'd always go in, watch film, get a workout in, and prepare for who you're playing next. Jamarcus would never come in on Tuesdays. Myself and Charlie Fry were the backups. We took it upon ourselves to get him to watch some film on Tuesdays. So we bring some DVDs to his house. But to get to his house, for him to be up for this, we had to stop by Wendy's and pick up 10 bacon junior cheeseburgers.
10 junior bacon cheeseburgers.
Junior bacon cheeseburgers. Not we had to stop and pick up a junior bacon cheeseburger or two. 10.
10 junior bacon cheeseburgers.
A truly incredible story for so many reasons. Papa John cannot believe the amount of grub that Jamarcus Cheeseburger was inhaling back in the day.
40 pizzas in 30 days.
Yeah, well, if he was doing 10 every Tuesday, you do the math. That's more than 40 in 30. I mean, it's easy to get hung up on the 10 junior bacon cheeseburger part, right? But how about the fact that he would not come in on Tuesdays? Why don't we start right there? Because every quarterback is going in on Tuesdays, including your own backups. They're going in to watch film. The guy who's QB3 is going in on Tuesday to get a lift in, to get a workout in, to watch tape. But not Jamarcus. Your backups are, but not the number one pick overall. Not the savior. Not the alleged face of the franchise. I mean, there's leading from the front, and then there's that. There's leading from the front, and then there's staying home, waiting for your teammates to push bacon cheeseburgers down your throat. Has anyone ever cared any less about anything than Jamarcus Russell did about football during that particular period of his life? Hell no, he wasn't going into the facility on his day off. Hell no, he was not going to watch tape on his day off unless someone hand-delivered it to him along with 10 individually wrapped bacon cheeseburgers. Again, quote, to get to his house, for him to be up for this, we had to stop by Wendy's and pick up 10 bacon junior cheeseburgers.
10 junior bacon cheeseburgers.
Junior bacon cheeseburgers. Yo, Jay. Yo, Big Dog. What's your address, Big Dog? We want to come over and study the Chiefs. My address? You got a pen? My address is Wendy's. Bruce, you go there first or I'm not home. That's funny, but that's funny, man. Really, what's your address? Wendy's Avenue. You go there, or I'm not home. Bruce mentioned the quarterbacks wouldn't just watch film on Tuesdays, but they'd get a workout in too. Yeah, I'm going to put myself out there and guess that Jamarcus was not throwing any iron around after throwing around 10 bacon cheeseburgers.
10 junior bacon cheeseburgers.
If you're making your backups, DoorDash you enough food to feed a large family, I seriously doubt that your next move is the elliptical. And based on the way Jamarcus looked when he left the NFL, I feel pretty confident in that assertion. If you need a bribe of 10 bacon cheeseburgers in order to watch TV, I cannot begin to fathom what he was demanding to do some actual cardio or lifting. Man, what a stud. What a power move. The $40 million quarterback having the backups bring him a sack of grease in order to get him to watch film. Credit to Bruce and Chuck for doing everything in their power to make this guy better. The problem is, it came at a cost of 10 bacon cheeseburgers.
10 junior bacon cheeseburgers.
You know the old saying, you can't outwork a bad diet. You mark me down for 10 cheeseburgers. Prove that. And even if you want to argue that the 10 were for the three of them, 8 of them still went to Jamark me down. And I'm not even going to argue that the 10 were for the three of them. Ben Mesrick. Ben, before we get into everything that you've got going on right now, I've got to ask, how are you and Tanya, your kids, and everybody around you doing in the middle of this pandemic?
Oh, man, we're doing pretty good. I mean, it's not all that different than my regular life. I mean, I'm locked down. We're bunkered down, but it's crazy, right? But we're doing okay, doing a lot of writing, so that's good.
It is crazy, and you are doing a lot of writing. Ben, there is so much to cover with you right now. I don't even know where to start, but why don't we start with season 5 of Billions? Well, then you've got the new serialized novel in the Globe. We have UFOs. We have a virus. We have Bitcoin. We have more. But you talk about how your life hasn't changed that much. A while back, let me start right here. You wrote an ebook about a virus hitting New York. What inspired you at that time? And unfortunately, how accurate were you?
Yeah, so I don't necessarily recommend anyone read that book right now. But I wrote a book called Q, which is an ebook, which I wrote. I started in 2002. And right after sort of the SARS epidemic, and it was about a coronavirus coming from China, hitting New York City and the quarantine response. And in my book, the virus was catching before you showed symptoms. And so the quarantine effort became quarantining people before they showed any symptoms. And it was weirdly very similar to what's happening, but much darker. So I wrote this dark dystopic kind of novel. I wrote it because I interviewed all these virologists and asked them what their greatest fear was. And unfortunately, it was almost exactly this. So that's what the book was about. It was called Q, and it came out, you know, I put it online, I think, about 3 years ago. It's dark, though. It's very dark. Only read it if you're in that kind of a mood.
It's dark and it's eerie. I mean, it's really eerie the way you laid that out and the way you called that. Now, as somebody who's paid a lot of attention to this topic and has written about this, how different, Ben, do you think life is going to be when this is over? Like, does life just go back to normal, or might we be looking at permanent changes in people's behavior?
I mean, listen, I'm an optimistic person at heart, and I think that, people adapt pretty quickly. And I also think that these things don't run for very long. I mean, when you're caught in it, it feels really dark and insane. But looking back in history, none of these epidemics lasted, you know, lifetimes. They last a year or 2 years, and it seems like a crazy number. But the reality is, I would say a year and a half from now, it's going to be a crazy memory we all share. I really do. I think that, you know, it's going to be a difficult summer, different than we're used to. And then into the fall, we'll have some medications and we'll have a vaccine and we'll get out of it. I'm sticking with the optimism. I just don't see this lasting as long as the dark sort of premonitions say, but we'll see. But certainly right away, we have to be careful. I mean, on the other hand, I don't think it's, you know, anywhere near as deadly as we thought originally. But it's scary stuff. I mean, it's age, you know, related, so it's stratified over age. So the older you are, the worse it's going to be. But in general, I think things will get back to normal. We'll see. Maybe a year. That's my guess.
Author Ben Mesrick joining us right now. Now, Ben, Billions had its season premiere last night. First off, what's it been like working on that program?
So I loved it. I mean, Billions is a show, you know, about the stuff that I write about. And it happened kind of out of the blue. Brian Koppelman, who is the writer-creator, and David Levine were basically on Twitter, and they had reached out to me because of my book, Bitcoin Billionaires, to talk about that book maybe becoming a movie. And while I was on the phone with Brian, he said, have you ever worked in television before? And I was like, well, I don't normally work with people. I don't usually even wear pants. I don't leave my house very often.
I don't work with people.
But he said, you know, I think you'd like it. Why don't you come into the writer's room? And can you be here like tomorrow? And so it was this crazy thing where all of a sudden I just went to New York and joined this writing room. And I had a blast. I mean, it was really fun to write about the characters like Axe and Axe Capital. It's just a really great setting to write. And I managed to get some crypto in there, if people saw the premiere last night. And I had a blast. So I was there. I'm a consulting producer on the show, and I wrote an episode that's going to air in 2 weeks. So my episode airs in 2 Sundays. I love the show. I had a good time. I think it's writing for TV was very different than what I normally do. But being around other people, it was a learning experience. Like, I didn't know if you have to like raise your hand to go to the bathroom or how that works.
Right. It's good.
I haven't worked with people ever.
It's good for you to mix with people, Ben. I love those guys. I met those guys for the first time back in the 90s. I had a meeting with them. I've always loved them. It's an amazing show. I was thrilled to see you be a part of that. And you did work in some Bitcoin last night. So let me ask you this, a crypto presence, I should say. Where are you? How much has changed in the Bitcoin world in the past year? And what do you make of where Bitcoin is right now in terms of evaluation?
Yeah, so I wrote Bitcoin Billionaires about the Winklevoss twins and their crazy rise in Bitcoin. Bitcoin, it's actually doing pretty well, all things considered, considering the whole world is crashing. Bitcoin is back, you know, coaxing towards 9,000. It took a dip all the way down when this stuff first happened, which was unusual because the idea behind Bitcoin is it's like a hedge. The world collapses and people can move into Bitcoin because it's not tied, you know, to the market, supposedly, but it actually started to act a little bit weird for a while. Then there's this big event called the halving event, where the amount of Bitcoin that goes into the system is going down by half. So that should create a lower supply, and thus the price should rise. So you ought to see the price of Bitcoin rising. Listen, I don't recommend anything financial to anybody because I'm, you know, not an expert in those things, but I don't see any reason why the price of Bitcoin wouldn't go up. And honestly, as the world sort of hits chaotic things and you get nervous about other things, listen, if I were in Venezuela right now, I would much rather have Bitcoin than a Venezuelan dollar. And looking at the American dollar and how they're going to be printing it like paper to pay for all of this stuff, you would think Bitcoin would be a pretty safe bet. So similar to gold, I think Bitcoin and gold are two places where you might want to have a little bit of your money. But, you know, in the end, nobody knows anything, so we'll see. But I do think Bitcoin makes sense. And as we move forward, as long as there's a demand, the price should go up.
We're talking to Ben Mezrich. All right, so yesterday, your serialized novel, The Mechanic, made its debut in the Boston Globe. And going with a serialized novel in a newspaper is an old school Charles Dickens approach. How did this idea come to be? And for those who do not know, what is The Mechanic about?
Yeah, so out of the blue, you know, like everyone else, you know, you're sitting in your bunker, scared to death about what's going on outside. And I got a call from the editor-in-chief of the Boston Globe, and Linda Henry, and the Henrys own the Globe, John Henry and Linda Henry. And they basically were like, you know, this is an old school idea, but we were thinking it would be really cool to have a writer write a novel for us, and we'll publish it daily. And this is something like Dickens would do or Mark Twain would do, not normally what you would see someone like me do, but I thought about it and I was like, this would be really cool if I could do like a complex, like Da Vinci Code type of thriller. And I'm not necessarily known for fiction, but I have written a fair amount of fiction, and I always wanted to be a thriller writer like, you know, Dan Brown or John Grisham or something. So I concocted this crazy thriller. They launched it on Sunday on the cover of the Sunday Globe, which was really neat. And it's been on the, essentially in the newspaper and online on the cover. Today, two more. So basically, two chapters are written or are published a day. And I'm really writing this book in like a 2 week period. So it is kind of insane.
Wow.
But I spent, you know, a week and a half plotting, planning, getting all the chips in order. So it's, I think people are going to be really into it. It's very sort of Boston. You know, it travels down the Freedom Trail, but it starts off just like bringing down the house and a card counter, getting caught up in something really crazy. So people who like my card counting books or like my other stuff are going to love it. And I'm doing it, you know, pro bono. I'm basically putting it in the Globe and hopefully people will like it. So it's on the bostonglobe.com. And listen, I don't know about you guys. I'm sick of reading about the coronavirus, and I feel like there needs to be something else. And I think it's a diversion. If you pick up the newspaper and, you know, everything's gloom and doom, but you can turn to this crazy thriller, maybe it'll cheer people up and make people happy. And it seems to be, people seem to really like it, and I love writing it. So, I think it's going to blow people away. And I am getting a lot of calls from Hollywood about it, so it'll probably end up turning into something else down the road. But people should go to bostonglobe.com and check it out. I think you got to subscribe to the newspaper or whatever, which ends up being cheaper than a book. But newspapers are good. I think we should be supporting local newspapers, so it's not a bad thing. So if you're sick of the coronavirus, you can read this crazy card-counting thriller and have fun with it.
Bravo. I love it, Ben. Ben Mesrick joining us. Ben, one last thought. I've always enjoyed our conversations, and especially when you have a new project. One of my favorites goes back to 2016 when the 37th parallel, The Secret Truth Behind America's UFO Highway, dropped. Last week, the Pentagon, of course, Ben, confirmed the videos of unidentified flying objects that had leaked a few years back, that they are in fact authentic. What was your reaction to that news?
I mean, listen, I know people think I'm crazy when I talk about UFOs. But the reality is there's no good reason not to believe in life in on other planets. And there's not a lot of reasons nowadays to believe that they couldn't have gotten here. So these Pentagon things that just got released, I mean, they were pretty interesting. You know, there definitely have been Navy pilots who saw something, and now they've got video of it. And I love how the Pentagon kind of just throws it out in the midst of all this craziness, because assuming, you know, it won't be the number one news story. And this is what I said when I was on your show. If aliens landed on the White House lawn, it wouldn't even be the top five craziest things that happened that day. And that's definitely true right now. And so this thing that got released, you know, wasn't even on the top of the newspaper. I mean, they literally released video of UFOs flying in front of Navy planes.
Seriously.
And so if they were drones, these guys would know they were drones. You know, these were not something that we can figure out. This was the Navy and the Pentagon saying, here's an unidentified flying object flying around. Now, I'm not saying it's aliens, but I am saying that's pretty weird, right? And so I love seeing that. If you read 37 Parallel, you'll know I'm willing to believe, as crazy as that makes me sound, but there's lots of craziness going on in this world right now, Jim, as you know. And I'm just sitting here in my bunker with Toby from Houston, you know, hanging out, checking out what's going on.
How many clones hit you with that, Ben? All of them? Listen, there you go, clones. You got him to say it. Go ahead. I'm giving a little ding. Ben referenced Toby in Houston. There you go. There you losers go. You got what you wanted. Ben's throwing you a bone.
I love the clones. I want the clones to read the Boston Globe. I think that would be, if the clones hit BostonGlobe.com, it will be beautiful, because that would be a wonderful thing. No, Jim, you're an awesome supporter of me. And as I've said many times, Bringing Down the House would not have been a successful book without you, and I can say the same for most of my books. So we have a shared history that goes back a long time, and it's awesome to talk to you in this craziness.
Ben, you're my guy. The jungle loves you. I love you. You've been a very, very good friend of the program long before any of this happened. You've always stayed extremely loyal to us. Whenever you have a new project, not only do you come on to support or promote the project, but you always make us first, and I always appreciate that. I love what you're doing for the Boston Globe. Clones, let's be very clear about this. You just got your Toby in Houston reference from Ben Mesrick, so you need to go to the Boston Globe and read The Mechanic and support Ben in any way you can. Ben, stay safe. I appreciate you. Best to the family, and I know we'll do it again soon.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. And have a good day. And keep it up. It's going to be fun.
Let's find out. We go to Wisconsin. Bob in Wisco. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing great today.
Good.
It's actually nice here.
Good.
So my wife and I, in about 2008, we went and we traveled in Japan. And we homestayed with a Shinto priest and his family. So one night they take us out to this little sushi place that's down by the ocean. And we're in there, and they knew I liked sake, so we're drinking sake and getting pretty well lit up. And all of a sudden, the Shinto priest, he disappears. But I'm there with the rest of the family and all that. We're doing fine. So he must have went home, and he comes back, and he's got this bottle, and it's a bottle of sake. And he says, if you drink this, you get the power of the hornet. So we look in it, and here it is, and it's got a whole bunch of those giant Japanese hornets floating in it. So this is murder hornet infused sake. So my wife and I, we both get a little cup of this stuff, and they like pushing us to see what we would do. So we both drank it. And about 20 minutes, my mouth was just dead numb from the venom that it infused from those hornets that were in there. It was just unbelievable.
So let me ask you something. Like what? Okay, two questions. If you weren't already wasted, would you have done that?
I probably would have, because they like to see how far they could push us. They'd, you know, put some really odd food and stuff in front of us. But it was, you know, I'm pretty up for pretty much trying lots of different stuff.
Hey, Bob, if they had said go in front of a moving train, would you have done that?
No.
Okay, good. So if it made your entire mouth go numb, what'd it do to your head?
Well, yeah, I was pretty out of it. I hadn't been that set back by alcohol for years.
And this was at the behest of a priest.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a fun guy, though. It was a lot of fun. I took a bottle of tequila with the worm in it, and I made him drink that and eat the worm.
Wow, man. Good times.
Good night.